Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Jared Steed appearing on behalf of the appellant Adrian Sasson Vanosloo. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, please.
Proceed.
Thank you. Your Honors, each of the 5 firearm enhancements in this case must be dismissed for insufficient evidence. Moreover, Mr. Sasson Vanosloo is entitled to a new trial on underlying charges because the trial court erred in dismissing a qualified juror during trial. The briefing also discusses numerous reasons why the court erred in imposing discretionary legal financial obligations and why the state failed to prove the operability of the firearm in question here. Unless the court has specific questions related to those issues, I intend to focus my time.
Let's deal with the firearm issue.
Sure. The insufficiency argument, Your Honor?
Yeah. The argument here is that he's engaged in drug trafficking.
Correct.
The drugs are in the back of the car. So to sell the drugs, he's got to go to the backpack, the gun's with the backpack. Why isn't it a reasonable conclusion that taking possession of the backpack and the drugs to engage in trafficking, he's also then in possession of the gun?
Well, I have 2 responses to that, Your Honor. The first is that under Mills, there needs to be a required showing of a nexus between the client and the firearm, and there also needs to be a showing between the firearm and the charged underlying crime. Our contention here is that neither one of those criteria is satisfied. First, with respect to the connection, the nexus between my client and the firearm, under Gursky, Mills, and Johnson, he is not in a position. This firearm is not readily accessible to him as the driver of the car during the commission of the offenses or at the time the police respond to. The testimony is quite clear on this matter. The backpack is found about a foot away from the firearm. It's in the rear cargo hatch of the car. That backpack, that firearm, could not be reached by the driver of the car. It would require him to exit the vehicle and or get out of the driver's seat and move into the rear part of the car to access that.
But the allegation wasn't that he was engaged in a drug trafficking offense at the moment he was stopped.
Well, that is what the court in denying the motion to dismiss the firearm enhancements here for insufficient evidence did find that this was part of a continuing drug possession distribution behavior. But what's important to note there is that in all of the cases in which that has been found to exist, that's Ekin Road, a number of other cases that are cited in the brief, Neff, each one of those has a specific set of facts that are absent here that allow the court to draw that inference between a connection between the firearm and the drug possession. It was, in many instances, admissions by the client or their co-defendants that they were armed and ready to use that if necessary. In many of those cases, there was evidence that the person, in addition to possessing the firearm and the drugs, also possessed surveillance equipment, police monitoring equipment. And in Neff, particularly, the court also took issue with the fact that the revolver, which was found in the garage which contained the methamphetamine manufacturing tools, it was unclear from the record whether that was within, you know, reasonable access as far as the client was concerned. We don't have a problem here in the record with the absence of those facts demonstrating that, you know, at the time the police respond, at the time he's driving the car, this shotgun and these drugs were not available to him.
It's at the time we look at, though. The question is, do we look at the time when he stopped, or do we look at the time when he is alleged to have been engaged in the selling of drugs?
Well, Your Honor, to the extent that we're examining it from the standpoint of a nexus between my client and the gun, that's when we examine it.
At the time he stopped?
At the time that he stopped, correct.
And at the time. Well, let's say the facts were a little different. Let's say we had someone that saw him selling drugs out of the back of the car, but it was dark and they couldn't see anything more than he was standing at the back of the car and a transaction took place, so they didn't see the firearm.
Okay.
Would that have been enough to establish the nexus between the firearm and your client?
Well, I'm going to respond in 2 ways, Your Honor. First, under that hypothetical situation, my client, or the client in that instance, is viewed in proximity to the drugs themselves, and assuming under your hypothetical the firearm is near the
right,
drugs,
it's in the same place it was found.
Then he's in physical proximity to both of them. But the second point here is that the problem with a hypothetical in this situation is case law makes clear that this analysis, this court's analysis, is very fact-specific to the particular circumstances at issue. And so if we're diluting you know, what happened in this case with what theoretically could happen in another set of circumstances, then we're not analyzing this based on de novo review
but
that's required.
The passengers testified that they drove around and sold drugs, and the drugs were in the trunk, so we know he had to get in proximity to the firearm to retrieve the drugs.
Well, Your Honor, the passenger testified to a number of things. One, that, you know, initially they were returning.
Assuming we believe the testimony that I outlined, it isn't it true that that puts him in proximity of the gun whenever he's in proximity of the backpack a foot from the gun?
Not necessarily, because under her testimony, she didn't testify that the gun was in the car. She didn't recognize
her seat. Don't we draw the inferences most favorable to the state in the context of your appeal? We have testimony that he is selling drugs from place to place. It's undisputed the drugs are in the back of the car, and it's undisputed that the firearm was within a foot or so of the backpack containing the drugs. Is it a reasonable inference that he sold drugs out of the back of the car and that he was standing near the gun when he did so, based on the testimony that he was selling drugs given by the passenger?
Your Honor, to the extent your question deals with, you know, how is this court viewing the evidence, I agree that in a sufficiency argument, it's viewing it in the light most favorable to the state. I don't think that changes the conclusion that the court needs to reach in this particular set of circumstances, because if you look at the facts of Gursky, there's no question that the drug and the drugs and the gun, which are both in the backpack, are in the same car as Mr. Gursky, and he's actually stopped and viewed as the driver of that car. But significant to the court's determination that that nexus wasn't established was the fact that he was unable to access either one of those from the position of being the driver of the car. We have the exact same situation here. And, you know, to the extent that the trial court concluded that this was part of a continuing business enterprise to sell drugs, we don't have any of those other sets of facts that courts in various jurisdictions have found relevant to making that determination.
Good morning. May it please the court. Kimberly Talene on behalf of Whatcom County for the state of Washington. Under Mr. Sasson-Venezlu's attorney's analysis, Eckenrode would have not affirmed the firearm enhancements, because in that case he was arrested in the front yard. It was the enterprise, the drug dealing, the manufacturing, and the loaded weapons in the home, and it was that entirety that the court looked at in determining that, in fact, there was the appropriate nexus between the defendant, the crime, and the weapons. In this case, Eckenrode is what the court should look for guidance.
But there the weapon was out in the open, so if he had gone into the space, it was readily accessible, as I recall.
Correct. Which
but,
is.
But the court has said having a weapon even closer, but inside a backpack with the drugs, doesn't cut it. He couldn't get to it.
Well, in Gursky, the difference is that in that case, there was no allegation that Mr. Gursky was drug dealing from the car. So the fact was he was in possession of the drugs. The drugs were in a backpack. In that same backpack within the zippered container was also a loaded weapon. And so that's the distinguishing factor here, is that here you have Mr. Sasson-Venezlu, who was driving around using this vehicle for his drug trade. There was ample overwhelming evidence of that. Not only were there drugs found in the backpack in the back, where he had bundles of the cocaine in the red backpack in the hatchback, but he also had scales, he had bundles of bills, he had additional pills, I believe, in the body of the car in the back seat. The weapon itself was situated, if you look at, I think counsel said the backpack was about a foot away. I don't think that's accurate. At 17 RP 315 to 16, 337, 562, and 635, the testimony was that that was right under the backpack, and that the pistol grip was actually sticking out in a manner that was easily reachable so that it could be used in a heartbeat once that hatchback was open and accessible. So
Do you agree with the appellant's position that there has to be a nexus both with the weapon and with the crime, if I understood it correctly? And if so, is it the fact that the drug dealing was out of the car, is that a sufficient enough nexus to tie the weapon into being possessed for use in the crime, being armed with it?
To answer your first, you have two-part question there, and yes, there does need to be a nexus based on State versus Mills, I believe, between the defendant, the crime, and the weapon itself. To answer your second question, yes. I mean, that is the distinguishing factor in this case, was that we had extraordinary testimony and evidence of what the defendant was doing in this case with the vehicle. This was not merely just a pull over and stop someone, and in happenstance we found something in the back seat that, you know, that he had drugs and there was also a weapon.
Well, if he'd had a pickup truck and the drugs are in a backpack in the passenger seat and the firearm is in the bed of the pickup truck?
I think that would not be as strong of a case as this.
Is it sufficient?
It would, well, the sufficiency of the evidence would depend on looking at all of the evidence submitted below and the light most favorable. That standing alone, I would say, would probably be insufficient based on your hypothetical, because I don't know what the other testimony is in terms of the use of having those drugs and
so
using.
So the proximity of the drugs and the gun together is important to your.
It is important in this case. I mean, that is why that testimony is critical, that pistol, not only did it have Mr. Sessom-Benazou's DNA on it, but it was found in a manner that could easily be quickly used, likely in order to protect, defend, or offensively be used because he had so much heroin in the back of that backpack. So I would ask the court to look at the evidence in the light most favorable to the state. And you're not looking at what the court made its findings on. That is not the standard. The standard is whether there's any facts to support the juror's decision in finding this firearm enhancement. Turning now, if I'd like to turn to the other issue with respect to the juror, it all comes down in this case to counsel is relying on the wrong rule with respect to what we look at when a trial court is determining midway through testimony whether a juror should be excused. In that case, you know, I'm losing my notes here. Give me a moment. Looking at Criminal Rule 6.5 and RCW 2.36, they govern. And they give the trial court a great deal of deference in terms of deciding not only how to deal with issues that come up, but in terms of evaluating what the situation is and when it's appropriate to remove a juror. So, for example, I think it was Jordan, you know, it was found not to be an abuse of discretion, even though there wasn't a colloquy where the court determined that there had been a juror who was falling asleep. Now, that case is distinguishable because there was not an objection from the other side. But here, despite there being an objection, the trial court was able to listen to what the issue was, and there was a concern of bias. It was a material witness for the defense who had testified, and a juror then realized that she had some knew who this person was, and this person in fact had helped a family member get them into much needed chemical dependency treatment. And
the trial court find that she was biased or simply that there was a possibility she might be biased?
I think that the court found that there was a possibility of bias. I mean, the statements, the court said it was I shouldn't say that. This court did not say one way or the other whether there was or was not, but did say it was a close call, and you can listen to her testimony. And, of course, what we don't have the benefit of and what you don't have the benefit of is seeing and hearing how she was answering questions. The prosecutor did try to ask questions, and it was clear from her answers, and I apologize, I wasn't able to find the transcripts yesterday. I think it was sent off to archives to go back over that. But my recollection is that she was really resistant to even the suggestion that she was happy that her family member went into chemical dependency treatment and finally kind of said, well, yes, I had happy feelings about that, or I felt good about that. And it kind of reveals the problem, if you will, of trying to vet a juror midway through trial, because the juror is already sitting on the panel. So the prosecutor or the defense counsel, you know, is not in the best position to be able to really vet them and determine how they feel about them. Not only that, even if they can't find them for a cause, they don't have the option of exercising a peremptory challenge. So let's say she had testified to that during voir dire, and let's say the court said that's not enough for a for-cause challenge. Well, the prosecutor would still have had the opportunity to exercise a peremptory challenge.
Why does that make any difference to us in this analysis?
Well, I think it makes It probably doesn't, other than it shows you why it's important for the trial court to have discretion in this case, because the trial court ultimately is in the best position to make these determinations. And we have another juror who's been fully vetted, who's been already chosen as an alternate. And so to remove and replace that juror causes no one any prejudice. So either side, and both sides, are entitled to a fair trial by an impartial jury. You know, the state is entitled to that as well. And so the court, I think, did its best to ensure that the parties were treated fairly and to ensure that there was an impartial jury that heard the evidence in this case. So if the court doesn't have any additional questions, I would ask this court to affirm Mr. Sasson Van Esloo's convictions and his firearm enhancements. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honors. I want to just address a couple quick more points about the firearm enhancements and then briefly get into the juror bias. First of all, I'm citing to page 10 of my opening brief and specifically to the record, 17 RP pages 316 to 17 and 565 to 66. A red backpack was in the cargo hold about 1 foot away from the barrel of the shotgun. Now, I just want to clarify that that's what the evidence shows. I'm not suggesting that that is a material analysis, the proximity between the gun and the backpack that this court needs to make here. Gursky makes very clear that, you know, that isn't factored into its decision for purposes of establishing whether there's a nexus between the client and the firearm. Both the gun and the drugs were contained in the same backpack in that case. Nonetheless, the Supreme Court overruled because Mr. Gursky, as the driver, was not able to access it. Moving to the juror dismissal issue, Your Honor, you know, essentially what happened here is a juror gave very unequivocal answers that she could remain fair and impartial, listen to all the evidence, and reach a conclusion and decision based on that. And she was dismissed simply because the passing knowledge that she had of this witness turned on the fact that this witness was crucial to the state's case. And, you know, I don't believe that we would be in the same situation here and that a juror would be dismissed under similar circumstances based on the answers that she provided, but for the fact that this witness was so crucial to the state's presentation of its case in chief. She very clearly told the bailiff that her passing relationship 2 years earlier with this woman would not affect her ability to be impartial and hear all the evidence. She made very clear that it was not her relationship with this woman or her assistance in getting her nephew into treatment that was what pleased her. It was the fact that her nephew got treatment at all. You know, and as a concerned family member, that makes perfect sense. So, you know,
the roles are reversed. I have a hard time thinking the defense wouldn't have been very anxious to have that juror off the panel.
If the roles had been reversed in the sense that this witness was crucial to the defense case, that may very well have been, Your Honor. But, you know, the roles may have been reversed in the decision that the court reached as well based on similar answers that a juror gave here. The court itself acknowledged that this was a very close case, that it, you know, both the prosecutor and the court, to quote, couldn't put their finger on exactly what made it feel unfair about having this juror continue on the case.
Isn't that one of the problems we have, second-guessing the trial judge? We don't get to see the facial expressions, the body language, the demeanor with which the court is examining how it feels about this person's ability to continue to be fair. I mean, certainly one of the earlier cases we had, and that was the argument about why we shouldn't read transcripts to juries. Isn't that same thing play true here?
Well, I would agree, Your Honor, that this court is not in a position to analyze, you know, certain visual observations, and that's true in any case. But notably here, we don't have the trial court making any findings or making any observations that, you know, this juror's body language or facial tics or what have you somehow influenced their decision. The record here and the trial court's findings suggest that it was based entirely on the verbatim oral answers that this court is privy to. And based on those unequivocal answers, this juror should not have been dismissed. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.